during the war in Vietnam. That is an astonishing, to me, that's an astonishing idea. I'm old enough to remember the war in Vietnam, and I remember people being on the streets. The fact that people are divided in their opinions now, and there is no sense of public outcry or outrage or even the same kind of level of curiosity about these events, indicates to me that journalism needs to redouble its efforts to find ways of explaining what's going on and doing it in a way that makes sense to people.
I'd like to talk some about the use of language by journalists. Sometimes when I'm listening very carefully or reading very carefully, I notice that things that do sound like they're facts have value-based words in them, even when you talk about who is attacking whom in the Middle East.
Oh,
is
boy.
Israel attacking Hezbollah? Is Hezbollah attacking Israel? And so, you know, I wonder, as I'm listening to the news, how much of that seeps in that I don't even realize.
Well, I think that's a good question. And there is language has become weaponized in a way, especially on the Middle East. It can be anything from the Israeli soldiers who were taken hostage by Hamas or Hezbollah. Were they captured or were they kidnapped? And whether you, if you say captured, that creates a sense of, to some, of the heroic act of Hamas or Hezbollah. If they're kidnapped, they're a victim. And that becomes a kind of a pro-Israel way of describing what happened. So the language has become so engaged in all of the politics of the region, and it's not just in the Arab-Israeli conflict. Issues around the war in Iraq or the war on terror. Is it a war on terror? Is the war in Iraq? Is it part of the war on terror? I mean, these are part of the arguments and issues that go on all the time. And my fellow ombuds at newspapers and broadcasters are constantly under a barrage from people who have very strong feelings on all of these issues. And I don't think there isn't a neutral place for the language. So what the best we can do is to describe what is going on, explain it in a contextual way, and then to help people come to their own decisions about what's going on. But no, language has been weaponized, that's for sure.
I'm going to pin you down just a bit more, and let's go back to the Middle East. How do you report facts without using words like attack, defend? Can you give an example if you were talking to a journalist who really did want to understand better how to report the facts? How do you talk about bombs and killings and victims?
Well, first of all, there's no sense of neutrality in the massacre in Rwanda. You can't say, well, here's the Hutu side and here's the Tutsi side, and then try to be neutral. There's no such thing as neutrality when people are dying. But the causes of the violence are something that journalists have to explain. If the reporting is simply confined to telling the stories of death and destruction and brutality without any of the historic or political context, then it becomes a very emotional subject. The thing that I think is important is that you have to tell the stories of human tragedy, but you also have to understand history and you have to understand why this has happened. This event in South Lebanon didn't happen out of thin air. And one example of that I recall is that during the war in the Balkans in the early 90s and during the siege of Sarajevo, where for I think more than 12 or 13 months the Serbs had the Bosnians surrounded and they were picking them off with snipers and it was horrible and people were starving and freezing to death, And we, at the CBC, we had a reporter inside Sarajevo living with these poor people and reporting on their plight. And then one night, as a report came in from Sarajevo on the satellite, it was an extraordinary story of tremendous dignity and great courage and horrible suffering. And I looked around the newsroom in Toronto, and nobody was listening. Nobody in the newsroom was listening because they had become bored by it. They were suffering from a kind of compassion fatigue. And I realized at that point that we had been telling only one kind of story, which was the suffering of the people, which was an important story to tell. But if you don't tell it without any kind of sense of hope or sense of context or sense of what else might happen, then people, for their own mental health, stop listening. And I think that that's the issue that is necessary for good reporting in all these cases, is you have to put it in some kind of context, whether it's Hurricane Katrina or the war between Israel and Hezbollah or whatever. There has to be context. And context requires an understanding of history and an understanding of nuance. And that's what's important, too.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Jeffrey Dvorkin, former ombudsman of NPR and now executive director of the Committee of Concerned Journalists. We've been discussing the role of a healthy media and robust democracy. I'm Karen Hammer of Heads Up Radio on KGNU in Boulder in Denver, Colorado. Heads Up is a weekly news and public affairs program offering special pre-election coverage designed to help...
And that was Sprouts. You're about to listen to Free Radio Santa Cruz's Bathrooms, Beers, Broadsides. A few minutes late, but stay tuned. Welcome to Bathrop's Beers Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're broadcasting at 101.1 FM and freakradio.org. In the studio with me are two guests. It's unusual starting out with two guests, but hey, we're getting it together here. Two knowledgeable guests, it sounds like, but we'll see how they do with the grilling and the quiz we have in store for them. And, of course, you're going to be welcome to call in and ask questions of your own, make comments. That's what the show is all about. Call-in number is 427-3772, 427-3772. We have Tammy Singh. Hey, Tammy, say hello.
Hi, how are you doing, Robert?
I think we have the right mic. Say hello again.
Hi, Robert.
That's a little better, I think. Yeah, we got, there we go. I think that's the right one. And we also got Tim Rumford. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Robert. How's it going?
Get closer to the mic when you talk.
Hello, hello.
I think that does it.
Say something. Please return the stewardess to her original upright position.
I think we got the stewardess returned. All right. So, Tammy, you've been around Santa Cruz for how long now?
I was raised here, and briefly I just left for college, Fresno State, and marriage, and I'm back here living.
How old are you?
I'm 46 years old.
And Tim, are you a newcomer, an old-timer? What's your deal?
I've been here since I was 6 years old. I had a seven-year hiatus in Hawaii, but besides that, I lived here since I was six, and I'm 40.
Well, Tim, I ran into you, I guess, two or three months ago when, although you've been kind of active at various things that I haven't really been too aware of, but you've been on the periphery of my consciousness, you came into my awareness when I learned you were starting a food program downtown on Monday, feeding the rabble and the riffraff in front of New Leaf Market.
Yes, that's true. I've started a homeless feeding program on Monday night at 6 o'clock. We're in about our eighth week. I chose Monday nights because after interviewing about 50 homeless people, they all said Mondays and Thursdays were the nights and the days that they have the most trouble being fed. So we started up this program. We've had, at first it was just me and my girlfriend cooking and going down there. Since then, we've had a lot of community support. I don't take any corporate sponsors, any faith-based money, anything like that, but it's just been people chipping in and helping. People come down, they play music. Some of the homeless people are actually volunteering, helping unload, helping clean up afterwards. It's sort of slowly been growing.
6 o'clock every Monday night?
Yeah, and we encourage people to come down. We need blankets, we need socks, we need food.
Yeah?
Yeah, so we encourage people to come down 6 o'clock every Monday night. We're there.
And I know that Wednesday night was kind of a combination sing-along, play-along, agitate-along, feed-along program that the SAFE, Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression, a bunch of musicians that I've been supportive of, has been doing now for about 2.5 years.
Yeah, very successfully.
So you're just a pale imitator of SAFE, aren't you? I saw you guy. You got instruments. You got. What are you trying to do? Is it a carbon copy thing?
No, actually, they support me, too. I started on Wednesday night. To see, you know, just to sort of get a feel for what was going on in the community and what they were doing. But because so many other groups feed on Wednesday nights, that's the night that the most groups feed. You know, it's there's people getting fed everywhere. That I made the decision to move it to Monday nights, although several of the same people come on Mondays. Mike, Valerie, a lot of people have been showing up on Mondays and playing music. Sort of starting the same sort of thing where we have music and it's not just food, where it's not just an atmosphere where you sit in the gutter and eat your dinner. You know, New Leaf has been leaving the tables open. I don't know if that's on purpose or not, but people have been able to sit down and eat.
Tammy, what do you think of all this feeding stuff? Have you been involved in any of this yourself?
Hi.
I'm sorry, my mic was way down. I hope people heard that. Tammy, what's your reaction to this?
I've worked myself quite with Santa Cruz Bible and the missions here on the feeding, and also I donate and feed many homeless myself when I have time. And I think it's very awesome that there are people like Tim and others, volunteers, that put their energy into that, and that we really do need more people like that, because there's over 2,600 people that I, on a ratio here in Santa Cruz, that are homeless without places to cook, and the vouchers just aren't enough to go around for these programs anymore.
You know, what's interesting to me, and I was actually going to talk about this last show, but I didn't have the time to do it, although I do a show on Sunday, for those who don't know, those who just tuned in. The name of the show is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, on both days, and the Sunday one is much longer. It runs from 9:30 in the morning to 1 o'clock in the afternoon. There has been, and I'm kind of looking back at my notes, some real controversy, which people may have even seen referred to in the Sentinel, about the crackdown on feeding programs in Orlando, Florida, and in Las Vegas, Nevada. And I think I was going to actually get into that at some length. Didn't have time, and I think I may be able to, I might kind of refer to some of that stuff. And I'm looking for it here even as we speak. See if I can dredge it up. All kinds of other issues I seem to be dredging up, but I'm still looking for that one. Let's see here. Come on. Alrighty, let's take a look here. Boy, everything but what I'm looking for. But it's, let me go back one more time here. In Las Vegas, and I'll just speak from my recollection of what's been happening, the city has been fighting. You know, the mayor, first of all, decided he would round up the mentally ill on the streets and lock them up in institutions if they didn't, even if they didn't want to go, because he thought that they, I mean, they alarmed the tourists and the potential gamblers and who knows, the folks seeking entertainment. Then he was informed by the authorities that they had no facilities to lock people up with, so his next move was to shut down feeding operations in Las Vegas. And I guess the response to that was the media went out, and actually they covered it. So they actually arrested people from the media around that issue, too, which is, you know...
The local radio station.
Yeah, it was, and I'm actually still looking for that particular story, which... I'm hoping to find, but I haven't yet found.
Beth Morris was the lady that took the ticket for the radio station.
What do you recall about that?
KZRZ, I believe it is, their local radio station. They came down to feed them donuts, coffee, and juice. She took a $1,000 ticket, and possibly faces 6 months in jail. They spent the whole day out there. They were eventually shut down. She was arrested. I've also spoken to some of the other more elusive, you know, groups that feed out there, just people sort of like me. They're also taking tickets and continuing to feed. So far, I don't think anything's made it through the courts enough for anybody to go to jail, but it could give somebody a six-month stint. And you know, you can go to jail for not feeding your dog. I was going to say, you can go to jail for not feeding your dog, but you can also go to jail for feeding a human.
Well, interestingly enough, I found August 1st, here's Mayor Goodman from, Las Vegas. Local radio station defies Las Vegas homeless ordinance. So no feeding laws put Las Vegas in the world spotlight. And Oscar Goodman isn't backing down, never one to keep his feelings on the inside. The mayor has some choice words for the local radio station that's been bringing donuts and sodas to homeless in city parks. England, Malaysia, and South Africa are just a few of the places where Las Vegas is making headlines because of the ban on feeding the homeless in city parks. As we saw Monday, some of the mayor's critics deliberately stirred up some publicity of their own. City marshals moved in to make arrests and issue citations when employees of KKLZ, I guess is what it says, radio, tried to serve a little breakfast to the homeless people of downtown Las Vegas. Beth Monk was the first to get a ticket that carries a fine of up to $1,000. Mayor Goodman is not amused with this deliberate attempt to violate the city's new ban on feeding the homeless. These folks are coming in and leaving. I'm not going to tolerate that, he said. I'm just concerned we don't have efforts in the right area. Goodman says his efforts are anything but cruel. His city is actively finding ways to get long-term help for those who need it. It's interesting, in Santa Cruz we have a similar claims by people like former mayor and now city council candidate Mike Rodkin, and of course Mayor Cynthia Matthews, both of whom are running for re-election for the Santa Cruz City Council. We have a law in Santa Cruz that doesn't ban feeding people, although there's pressure from the Downtown Association, I should say. I don't know if it actually officially comes from that association or from scattered merchants, but there has been such pressure in the last 2 or 3 years to stop feeding in public places on the streets. And certainly there were arrests a decade or two ago, and I was one of the people arrested for serving people free food at the town clock as part of the protest against the violence against the homeless and the law, which I was kind of referring to earlier, the sleeping ban law, which Rodkin and Matthews support, which makes it illegal not to feed or not to eat, but to sleep at night after 11 o'clock at night. So I guess you can get your meal in Las Vegas, and then You better stay. You may kneel here, and then you go over to Las Vegas, and you can sleep. So that's
the people on the side of the anti-feeding stuff are saying that the people feeding other people takes away from them going to county services, which there are not enough of anyways. Even if everyone did go to the county services instead of going to the local feedings, they wouldn't have enough beds, they wouldn't have enough food. It just doesn't work. It doesn't. Their thing doesn't stand up.
Well, I know that in Santa Cruz, Food Not Bombs, which serves at least two times a week, I think sometimes three, one of them most famously at the Wednesday Farmers Market in lot number 4 in downtown Santa Cruz, was running afoul of the parking lot panic law, as I called the early version of the parking garage paranoia law, which we now are saddled with, but which is not yet apparently being directly enforced, except against homeless people in parking lot number 9 across from the Elm Street feeding program, up next about near the Union Grove Pacific and Catalyst areas up there, for those who know the downtown area, metro area along Elm Street. And it's... it's a real question of how. To me, it's very well for us to shake our fingers at Orlando and shake our fingers at Las Vegas. The real question is, what do we do here? I guess we can say, well, we're so much better because we don't arrest people for feeding. But of course, the reason that is because a lot of us did get arrested for feeding about 15 years ago, and when. It's. I don't know if Rotkin was actually involved in that. I continue to use poor Mike Rotkin as a punching bag here because, frankly, I think he not only symbolizes but actively promotes a lot of the anti-homeless agenda, masquerading as a pro-homeless agenda. You know, he uses the same kind of arguments that, you know, here Mayor Goodman is talking about. We're really trying to help all these people. These are just outsiders. We don't want to, I don't know if Goodman says this, one of Rotkin's arguments for keeping the sleeping ban is it would alienate the community and cause millions of people to come to Santa Cruz, by the way, he's probably using hyperbole, but he means cause a huge influx in Santa Cruz population, which is not reflected in any other places where sleeping bans have been lifted. And he continues to repeat this myth, or actually I have to call it a lie because it's not really a myth anymore. It's his just bald assertion he makes whenever it comes up. And then quickly follows up with three or four different arguments that, you know, leave it behind on the road. But, you know, the lie is still the lie.
It would be different if there was enough services around for everyone, you know, to get adequate places to sleep and adequate places to eat. Then maybe he would have an adequate argument, but there aren't. And so I think, you know, the community needs to step up and start doing stuff on their own, because I don't think we can count on the city council anymore to do this stuff. No, I think people as humans need to start standing up and start acting on their own.
No question about it. Tammy, any thoughts on this?
I, for the last 2 years, have been doing constant volunteering every day with families and especially the Hispanic community, being that they're so much targeted and have less opportunity to knowledge on these programs and are let down or discriminated. I strongly fear to say that, but it boils down to that. And this is why when we had food out at the VFW, which I now call the KKK, it should be named instead of the VFW, is that they required them to pay $1.50 more because of their skin tone.
Which VFW? The Santa Cruz, Watsonville?
17th Avenue. 7th Avenue.
7th Avenue.
Yes.
And is this still happening? I mean, is there a meal with where the VFW is charging differential rates?
Well, they have a woman's auxiliary that controls the meals, but now on Wednesdays, but not so much as they used to. Now what they went to when it faded out there, would they jump into the bar and their dance time. And I was a bartender at the time.
What do you mean, jump into the bar and the dance time?
They would rent the hall, and this is a non-profit organization, I quote. they are charging for entrance fees and for rental, and the public or the veterans do not receive any of them funds. It goes, I've noticed, into four different new cars or an absence in the booking, like a $4,000. That's all documented. And
I'm a little confused here because I'm not sure. Are you talking? You're saying there's a charge for a feeding program. Now you're talking about entertainment. I mean, can you clarify these issues?
That it faded there for a while, and people got connected
doing. What faded?
The charging of the higher price.
Now, how did before it faded? What exactly was being done?
Well, I was word of mouth.
Yeah. What did you hear?
Well, I went to persons that I knew individually and made sure they knew.
What did they tell you? I'm trying to understand what happened. It's not clear to me what happened.
It was either charge more or lose your job type.
Wait a minute. Again, you're not telling me what actually happened to a person approaching a meal. Give me the story of how a person walks up to the door and says, I want some food. First of all, how often were their meals being held?
Every Wednesday nights they used to have
Wednesday
them
night,
once
popular
a week.
Night. and so what happened when a person went up there to get food? What would they do?
Based on who was the cashier at the time, they were led on to scan a person, I per se, which is a common phrase, and if they didn't seem to understand English per se, that they would charge a dollar more or $1.50 more if they could.
How many times? Who told you this story?
This was actually just sightful. And
wait a minute. You were there when you observed people charging a dollar more for Spanish speaking people.
Yes.
And what year was this?
This was about when Bud was commander, which is no longer there for these purposes. This is going almost 2 years now.
And for how long a period did this go on?
That passed 6 months, I would say, total.
Now, was this because of the concern about illegal immigrants? Was it simply straight concern about, you know, hostility towards people who speak Spanish? Was it hostility towards poor people? What was it?
No, it was pure greed, I feel, and the racial difference.
But would people pay? Did you observe, did people sort of walk away, or did they pay the amount?
No, they surely were paid. They thought that.
And how many people were served on Wednesday nights on this around this program?
Basically, there was enough food to serve up to 100 people.
And how much was the average person charged?
It was $5 a plate for a basic plate.
And $6 for the for the Hispanic plate. Maybe they threw in some tacos or anything. Hey.
Anything they had, yes. It was.
And how many times did you actually see this happen?
Being that I was in the lounge doing my job, it was during the times I did walkthroughs through the kitchen and just noticed the person doing
it. Happened
that.
Once, twice, five times, 50 times?
I've seen it on a regular basis. I could say my eyes itself four or five times.
And did anyone ever complain about this? Did it come up in a board meeting or a meeting of the group?
Well, the meetings, basically, to be honest, I hate to say it, but it was basically full of alcoholics.
Yeah, but were they compassionate alcoholics or mean alcoholics?
They were very, at
or
the
age. Or were
they
just oblivious alcoholics?
Angry.
Well, so was there, was the subject actually talked about, and then people said, well, them spicks or whatever, them wops or them folks, I can never get my racial epithets correct, because I remember which is which, them Mexicans, them greasers, and them greasers, I mean, it's good that them greasers don't have to do this, because we don't want their kind around. Were any VFW people actually of Mexican-American descent?
Not at that time, there was.
2 years ago, there was no VFW, and now there are, or
now the commander is a Hispanic gentleman.
Are they charging the Anglos an extra buck, or what's going on here?
No, it's now they got someone honest there as a commander.
Kim, is this woman a troublemaker? Is she telling us the truth? What's you're a feeding program expert here? Is this leftist rhetoric of some kind? What's this about?
I have a small opinion. The only thing I can tell you, because I don't know anything about that program, I only know what I witnessed in Santa Cruz City is where I'm more familiar, and for my own feeding program. But I will say that we do have a lot of Mexicans, immigrants, and Mexican Americans that come to the feeding, and a lot of them, I have to say about half of them who haven't been there before, look at me like they expect and sometimes ask, you know, how much? And I say, no, it's free, help yourself, that's what it's here for. And they seem a bit stunned and taken back, and then they eat and they come back. But so, you know, it's possible, but I apologize.
Go ahead.
Anyways, again, like I said, I've had many Mexican Americans and possibly immigrants, some that speak Spanish and some that speak American, come to me expecting me to charge them.
Have you? I know there's been some controversy at the Veterans Hall about the Potter's Hand program. I've heard that it's been kind of forced out into the parking lot. I haven't been down there. This is a Sunday morning program run by Dennis Adams. I had some problems sometimes with Dennis, and I other times I was praising him and supporting him when he fed on the streets for a couple of years downtown, 2003, and the downtown association people, or some merchants anyway, tried to pressure him away, and he eventually moved inside Loudon Nelson and served there, where he actually was serving every Sunday morning, a very tasty breakfast.
No seniors, cool. Right?
No, everybody.
Okay.
He served everybody. And I know that since then he's been serving in the Vets Hall, and there's been some controversy about Tim Bratton, who's kind of one of the overseers of the Vets Hall, an executive director. I'm not sure quite what his name is, his title is. And, we got a lot of critics on the air talking about him, and he's talked about his situation, too. I've interviewed him. He wouldn't go on the air about it, but he allowed me to kind of pass on his comments. And I know that recently there's been some controversy around Vets Hall. Have you heard anything about feeding programs either being kicked out or problems?
Okay, what I heard, again, is secondhand information, but from a fairly reliable source, that program was completely shut down due to the yoga people needing more access to the VFW hall, and that the Sunday feeding was now over.
Well, we have to have a spiritual approach to the whole thing. I mean, food is good, but spirituality, particularly if you're making money off of it at a yoga class, is even better.
This is faith-based. I mean, it's fine. Yeah, no, I've always had a little bit of problem walking by the VFW and seeing a yoga program there. Not that I'm against yoga, but I just don't think that's what the building is meant for. That's my personal opinion.
Your personal view. You're tuned to Free Radio, and the studio with me is Tammy and Tim, TNT, so to speak, in more senses than one. Tammy, you have been in housing. You're in housing now. Have you been homeless in Santa Cruz?
When I first came here, I came here with nowhere to go, and I was blessed. But I have approached, when I first came here, I approached Santa Cruz Bible for some food, and I had to be interviewed to see if I qualified for a food bag. And
what kind of questions did they ask you?
Basic questions, formatted income, residence, and work type questions, just your income verification, more or less.
They didn't give you a... are you wearing a low-cut dress thing like they used to do at Kuroda's Soup Kitchen in the early 90s?
Not quite. But
are you involved with homeless activists, things like that? Those questions didn't come up.
No, not at all. But
were you homeless for any length of time? Or?
Not at the time. I was blessed, like I said.
So you haven't really been homeless in Santa Cruz?
No, and I feel really, like I'm one step away always.
So what kind of rent do you pay per month?
$1,000.
And what is that for, a five-bedroom palatial mansion?
One bedroom.
One bedroom. Actually, that's pretty good for one bedroom.
Not bad.
And how's the landlord? Are they pretty good?
They're a very respectful couple. It's a quiet place where I live, and that's what I do appreciate.
I know that we recently had a couple, Tim and I actually helped her to move out. She was a tenants' rights activist, Donna Dice, and her partner Shane Maxwell of Trusk, Tenants' Rights Union Santa Cruz, and they were ousted in what appeared to be a retaliatory or perhaps it's called a constructive eviction. They can, evict you in Santa Cruz because we haven't got a city council that's had the balls to put in a renter protection law or rent control or any kind of eviction, just eviction controls. We have a situation where the landlords do pretty much what they want unless you can show that they're trying to evict you for organizing or whatever this constructive eviction thing is, which I'm still trying to understand. Maybe I will at one of these points. How long have you lived in this place?
It's been, October will be 1 year.
You don't have a lease, though. It's month to month, right?
Yes.
And you say that you were telling me about homeless people. The management doesn't want you talking to homeless people, and it doesn't want homeless people in the area. What's that about?
Yes, and I do see his point, but then again, it hurts me that I can't.
What exactly did he tell you in terms of your orders? Are you ordered not to look at homeless people? Do you have to beat them whenever you see them with a stick? What exactly is the requirement?
We're not allowed to talk to the homeless in our complex.
Wait a minute. So in your you can't invite a homeless person into your house?
No, sir.
You can't. Now, do they have armed guards patrolling the hallways to make sure? Do they have a snitch system set up? I mean, how are they going to make sure that you obey these rules? Are they going to brand H on the arm of every homeless person that comes in? What's the procedure here?
Well, where I live, it is not well known. It's close to the levee and where the bridge is, and so it is a known area where the people, could sleep. And I find it quite nice for the homeless people because you can't see in there. They got a little privacy you can have.
You're talking about not in the apartment property you're in, but
right.
in surrounding areas.
Surrounding.
Is this near Camp Paradise by chance? The old Camp Paradise,
which
is Highway 1 bridge over the.
Yes.
And how were you told when you moved in that there was a special no communications with the homeless clause in the.
No trafficking, which I enjoyed that one, drug trafficking, because I really feel more at peace when there's not that going on.
Mm-hmm.
But more so to also know homeless people. That law was suggested.
Now, are you allowed to have people in your room at night, your guests? I mean, if you want to invite someone over, is that. I mean, you're only 41, and you're just a kid. 46. But 46. I mean, maybe when you get to be 50 or 60, they'll let you, bring someone overnight. Now you have to have a chaperone. What's the deal with that?
I think it's basically a respect for your neighbors on that turn. But,
so there is a rule, no overnight guests?
No, there's not a rule on that.
You just have to be careful not to make too much noise.
Yeah, you want to respect your neighbors. And, I mean, I feel personally that way. Now, if that kind of runs into that traffic rule, the trafficking and noise.
So you can drug deal with non-homeless people, but not with homeless people.
Yeah.
Is that the deal?
Well, there's none.
You can buy those expensive pharmaceuticals that will kill you pretty quick and cost a hell of a lot of money, but don't go buy any marijuana from the local homeless, right?
Yeah, it kind of runs together, but yeah. And, but he did make an opportunity. We can meet him up at Denny's to feed him if we feel we want to go somewhere else and do it, in other words. And
but you're actually saying that this landlord has said that as an adult, you're not allowed to invite other adults who are law-abiding people of your own choosing into your place.
No, just homeless. He didn't want homeless people.
Right. Law-abiding adults are okay, but dirty, raggedy, or even clean, but they might get homeless-type people are not wanted. Is that right?
Yeah, basically.
And has this impacted you? I mean, do you feel like when you'd like to invite someone in to talk, or maybe invite them in for a sandwich, or even be seen sharing a Coke with them outside, this is something you don't want to do because you're afraid your rent might be jeopardized, your tenancy might be jeopardized?
The Coke outside, soda, yes, I do.
Right.
On that part.
Do you ever give money away to homeless people nearby? Is that a no-no? You're not allowed to do that?
Yeah, well, anything, period. And
so if a homeless person was hit by a car in front of your house, would you kind of wait until the ambulance comes?
No, I wouldn't. I would jeopardize
you'd risk your rent.
I would save the person's life.
Interesting. Very interesting. I would like, of course, the name of this fucking landlord and the address of the place, but I realize that would put you probably out on the street. Or might, so I'm gonna hold off on this. Maybe we can get this information some other way, another time. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. We are, in fact, streaming and broadcasting. I'm Robert Norris. In the studio with me are Tammy and Tim. you want to join the show, if you have any stories or thoughts or reactions of your own, you can do so by calling in, 427-3772, 427-FRSC. If you want to call off air because you've got questions about the station, like maybe you got a public service announcement, or maybe you want to donate equipment, or maybe you want to get a show of your own, there's another number to call. It is 427-4523, 427-4523. If you want to call the city council and complain about there not being a just rent law, about none of these clowns who are running for city council, and I think that we're stuck with the group we got. I think the race closed today for city council candidates for November, and we got Rotkin Matthews, Lynn Robinson, Bruce Van Allen, Michael Tomasi, some guy called Chris Kopp, Simba Kenyatta, and I think that's maybe a couple more I haven't heard of, but it's a pretty grim scene. I'm going to try to get Simba on the air to talk with him. He's an African-American activist who helped put together the Commission for a Police Citizens Police Review Board way back in the early 90s, and he's been an activist for quite a while. Maybe we can get him in the station to talk. Maybe we can get you guys out there, whoever you are, you men and women, to call in and give your thoughts on what you're hearing. I know I talked to one person downtown, lives in the Palomar. He was told that even though he's an adult, he can't have people overnight in his room, which I found very bizarre. And actually, I didn't find that bizarre, but I found it, you know, I mean, you're talking about people paying a monthly rent and who are probably somewhat subsidized either by the state or the feds or, the city. I don't know. And this kind of medieval paternalistic, I don't mean paternalistic, it's just sort of company store approach where you've got to, I guess you don't have to buy your food, and they're not selling you the items, but they're imposing these severe restrictions on you. I know that kind of restriction also has been the subject of some research you've been doing for around the one of our biggest tax people. Actually, they give, I guess, a small fraction of the amount of money they take in, but they are, the city council thinks that they're worthy of $380,000 a year to give to the CVC. That's the Seaside Company, which gets, the Rotkin Matthews City Council can't put together a legal challenge to get back the Tidelands, which the Seaside Company stole in the 30s. We could make lots of money off that, but they don't want to challenge the Seaside Company on that one. Instead, we get the Seaside Companies engaging in the kinds of practices that always have disturbed me: low wages, crappy accommodations, not much money back to the city. But what have you found in your research, Tim, around the Seaside Company? I know you've been researching them.
Yeah, I have been, especially in the last 2 days to get ready for this, and I was actually quite surprised. You know, I was hoping, I'm looking just for a little bit of corporate responsibility, just a tiny bit of corporate responsibility in our city. I feel that an employer that large, somebody that makes so much money a year, about $30 million a year net, has a responsibility in our city. And I looked, to see if there was any philanthropy done by the Seaside Company, who owns quite a bit of property. Seaside Company owns the Boardwalk, the Coconut Grove, the Carousel Motel, the Labahai Bahamas Apartments, the Sea and Sand Inn, the Boardwalk Bowl. A private corporation is also owner of Chardonnay 2 sailing yacht, Subaru of Santa Cruz, Toyota of Santa Cruz, and additionally, the company manages a number of residential units in Santa Cruz County. And when they say residential units in Santa Cruz County, they're mainly talking about the flats, which has been, an ongoing issue for the 20 years that I've been walking around here. And so I did a little research, and some of the stuff I have to be careful about when I'm talking about, because some of this comes from people who are working there, and they are strictly forbidden to talk to the press, to talk to any of this stuff. So if I seem a little bit hesitant, that's why. But I did pick up this ticket, and I'd like to start here. And this ticket is a trespass ticket that they are giving out to homeless people, or anybody who even looks homeless, who happens to walk by on the property. And the Seaside Company security there, who, interestingly enough, many of them end up in the police department. That's the most common route to the police department.
First alarm security?
Yeah, from the Seaside Company security, they most commonly end up in...
Seaside has its own security, I guess.
Yes, and now they're most common path employment path is the Santa Cruz Police Department. Anyway, so if you're homeless and you walk by, the gentleman that I spoke to said he was just walking through the front, but some people are taking aluminum cans out. But if they don't want you there, they give you this ticket, and I'd like to read it if that's okay.
Go for it.
It says, "You are hereby directed to remain off all private properties owned and operated by the Santa Cruz Seaside Company, to include the boardwalk and its facilities, the boardwalk bowl, the company parking areas, the Carousel Motel, the Sea and Sand Motel, the Lava High Motel, and all other designated company-owned property operated residential properties as may be specified. No part of this warning shall be constructed or nullified any law or agreement permitting lawful access to public beaches or public locations." The most interesting part, it says, "You have been contacted or temporarily detained by an authorized employee of the Santa Cruz Seaside Company, person to California Penal Code 4906, for the purpose of conducting an investigation to determine if there was probable cause to believe you were in violation of a lawful amusement park rule. Company rules include any violation of state or municipal criminal laws and are demonstrating disruptive, abusive or potentially unsafe behavior. Following the best of investigation, it has been determined that you are, or are not, this is checked, you are, in violation of company rules. You have been arrested or charged with a criminal offense pursuant to this detention. Your conduct has been determined in violation of company rules. Your privileges of visiting the Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk properties have been revoked. And re-entering the property within 12 months, you would be if you do enter the property within 12 months, you would be considered a criminal trespass. And the same goes for them if they visit a friend that happens to be on a residence owned by them. They aren't allowed to go to any piece of property owned by them."
I'm looking at this penal code. I'm trying to look it up. It's 490. You got the exact section of this?
Give me one second here. 490.6.
490. I'm still looking. Go ahead with what you're saying there.
Okay. Anyways, I've watched three of these tickets be given out. Two of them were for people who were picking up aluminum cans out of the front of the garbage cans. And they weren't causing any sort of disturbance. They weren't being violent. When I'm out there waiting, I've seen stabbings. I have seen drunk people allowed in with no problems. I've seen drunk people escorted off and allowed in their cars. But I see a homeless guy walk by, and just because he looks homeless and peeks in a garbage can but does not reach his hand in the garbage can, is given this, is escorted off the property, videotaped, and told never to come back or he will be arrested. To me, that's a little harsh. And considering the amount of traffic, violence that we've seen down there, the last thing that happened, one of the things that happened was a 19-year-old kid was stabbed two blocks, and was trying to walk to the boardwalk. So he got stabbed, and he made it to the boardwalk. Well, the day after, they put clippings out to all the employees. Don't talk to the press. Whatever you do, don't talk to the press. We've had an incident. Don't talk to the press. You talk to the press, you'll be fired. You know, that's pretty much their stance there, if you talk to the press. And they are the lowest paying, company we have.
What would they be talking to the press about again?
Well, they don't want them talking about anything. Their pretty much stance is you don't talk to the press about anything. You direct them to the operations department, and that's it.
Right. Interestingly enough, I looked at that 490.6 California Penal Code. It reads as follows. A person employed by an amusement park may detain a person for a reasonable time for the purpose of conducting an investigation in a reasonable manner whenever the person employed by the amusement park has probable cause to believe the person to be detained is violating lawful amusement park rules, which sounds preposterous.
A list of lawful rules.
If the person admitted in an amusement park refuses or fails to follow lawful amusement park rules after being so informed, then an amusement park employee may request that person either comply or leave the premises. The person refuses to leave the premises or comply, and the person will be deemed to be intentionally interfering with and obstructing those attempting to carry on lawful business within the meaning of the infamous Section 602.1, which, of course, is what the homeless, he's not homeless himself, but it's kind of a minister to the homeless, Jerry Henry, has been held on a $100,000 bail for out of the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center. In any civil action brought by any person resulting from a detention or an arrest by a person employed by an amusement park, it shall be a defense to that action that the amusement park employee detaining or arresting the person had probable cause to believe the person was not following lawful amusement park rules, and that the amusement park employee acted reasonably under all circumstances. I recall an incident where Wanda, an African-American activist who lives now, I guess, up in Scotts Valley, was detained because she made a remark criticizing the Ku Klux Klan, and some police officer found it offensive, and they separated her from her children. They held her, or I think the person who was with her, for a period of time.
Where did this take
place? This was in the Seaside.
Oh, this was Seaside.
Seaside Company. So it's interesting that they've shoehorned a rule in here that says, it's sort of like the city council. If you violate a decorum rule in the city council, they're now saying that they can accuse you of disrupting a council meeting, even though it may not have been disruptive in the common English sense of the word. Now, you didn't take off your hat, or you held up a sign in the middle of the room, even though nobody cared except the mayor. You know, you gave a Nazi salute when they started acting like a bunch of fascists at the council, as I did 4 years ago, and they had me arrested. But of course, they didn't charge me. But it's an example of the kind of repression they do. It sounds like the amusement park has you know, got this rule that they've gotten the state to pass.
And doing, like I said, this person wasn't doing anything. They just looked unsightly. Some of them were collecting cans, but the one that I witnessed just looked in the garbage can. I mean, he just peeked. He didn't even stick his hand in it.
How unsightly was he? I mean, was he dripping with feces?
No. I mean, we're talking a guy on a bicycle with a backpack. He wasn't necessarily even homeless. He was unsightly to them. But
was he unsightly to you?
No.
Would he be unsightly to the average person?
To the average tourist? To me, not enough to disturb them to, you know, their day.
Would the average tourist have liked to have seen that person removed from the area?
I don't think so. I think they would have rather seen the gang-banging drunk guys that I see going in there. I mean, I'm not trying to be
racist here. Or maybe the goose-stepping security guards.
I see really drunk, violent people walking in there, and I see them escorted out to their cars nicely with no investigation. You know, they make sure that somebody's sober driving them home. I watch them do donuts. I saw somebody pull a pistol out of his car afterwards, you know.
Well, it's an interesting question. How do you rein in the Seaside Company? I mean, I know there was a controversy last summer about the Seaside Companies trying to stop access to the beach around the Trestle Bridge.
Yes.
And there were some activists, including former Mayor Christopher Crone, who, to their credit, were trying to stop that and stand up to that, although apparently they were... they didn't want other less reputable activists, like Phil Baer, who lives in the beach flats, associating with the same group. You have this kind of silly, factional infighting. But, you know, I'm wondering what we can do as a community. I mean, you've got these, you know, this alarm about the violence that's happening in town. I mean, there's a huge upsurge of rape, is what I hear, in the last 4 years.
And plus, there was a lot of shootings and stabbings that happened in a short period of time, and they all happened in a four-block area of the beach boardwalk. And I was down there for three of them waiting to pick somebody up.
I think it's the roller coaster, the after effects of a too rigorous roller coaster ride.
The four-hour heat drive and the beer and the, you know.
Oh, boy. I don't know.
I myself feel it's anger and that nobody cares since the darn towers fell down, that people just have gave up a lot of faith, and they just don't care. And the ones that do, there's not enough of us. And we, even if there were, there's like that red
tape.
Well,
I don't know. I mean, think about this. We had thousands of people on the streets supporting the rights of Mexican Americans, Guatemalan Americans, or just people, immigrants who've come in here, workers in this country, on May 1st. Thousands, the biggest march in Santa Cruz in 3 years. And that march essentially stopped that, and other marches throughout the country stopped the legislation that the Republicans in the House wanted to felonize all immigrants, also called undocumented immigrants. Now, of course, we have a real problem, as we have this, you know, ongoing thing for 20 years where they just mess with immigrants big time. If you're, you know, you could be held indefinitely. Not just since 9/11. That was before 9/11. And it's just, you know, it's grotesque what's happened. There's no reform around that yet. On the other hand, as I've talked about on the air before, there is a real problem. And there's an interesting article in the paper today which talks about this, of people who are, you know, I mean, you have a situation where you can't get United Farm Workers Union type organizing done, because all they have to do is bring in more undocumented immigrants who are desperate for work and undercut the wages of the people who are already here. And I guess at AFL recently, there's an article in today's Chronicle, perhaps it's yesterday's Chronicle, talks about them forming an alliance with not the UFW, but the groups that oversee migrant labor. It's not really an organization. It's cities have formed organizations to control migrant labor. You know, you got rules. You got to stand here. You can't stand on the San Lorenzo lumber property. You have to stand off to the side.
Yeah, that's some stuff I like to.
You want to talk about that, Tim?
Well, a little bit. There's some stuff related to the Seaside Company regarding that. There is a Patriot Act. There is a part of the Patriot Act that came out in 2002 called. There's surveillance and international students called SEVIS, the Student Exchange Visitor Information System. The SEVIS program is a national computer system operated by the INS that became law in 2002 under the Patriot Act. Under this new law mandated by Congress, schools are required to input private student records on every non-resident studying in the U.S. on a student visa. Informations include country of origin, current address, major student financial status, misconduct. The government can expand this information on anything they deem relevant. Okay, that's students, but what they don't say in here, which is new, is that they also include exchange visitors, which is really another term for a worker program that nobody's really aware of.
The Bracero program, like they had in the 60s.
This particular one is called, they use this program, the SEVIS program, which is really them building a government database, and I think that they're using this worker exchange program just to enhance the database.
Well, how does this relate to the Seaside Company?
Well, they're using it.
Who's using it?
Seaside Company is employing through SEVIS overseas workers through.
From what countries?
Well, if I name the countries, I'm going to give away some information on some employees, the people who are living there that are very disturbed. That could give away their... they may come in here for an interview later.
Are there a variety of countries?
There are. From Slovakia would be a good...
From Eastern Europe?
Interesting. They're all high-paid people who are becoming lawyers who are told they're coming here like on a great vacation, and they end up paying for their flight. They end up paying $240, from what I understand, for their housing. They end up paying $100 for the... for the surveillance cost. that's the 1-901 fee. Then they get here and they have to sign, although they have to sign up for Social Security, they're not given enough hours by Seaside Company to get any benefits as well as nobody else's. They're paid less. They have to sign a law that says that they are not binded by overtime rules. Now, the people that I've had discussions with say that they are living in squalor. This is not what they expected. This is not what they were told. They came down here. They are disgusted. And if the Seaside Company's position is that they cannot fill all their positions with the people here. And if they paid higher wages and treated people a little bit better, maybe they could. But they are so staunch about that that in the material they give out to their employees, they say, look, we have a one-day contract with you, basically, and if you want to quit, you can quit anytime you want, and we will fire you anytime we want.
If you don't like picking strawberries, sir, you can go on to the next field, buddy.
So, you know, either we have enough jobs or we don't. You know, if hopefully this Minimum Wage Act will pass, and they are against it, by the way. Seaside Company.
Well, so is Neil Coonerty, our supervisor.
Yes.
I thought that they had... disagreed on passing it at all.
Say that again?
To my knowledge, that they had already disagreed on...
Who had disagreed?
The staff that... on the minimum wage issue, that they weren't going to pass
that
it.
That was the federal.
The federal.
Yeah, we're talking about a local initiative on the city that... the city council refused to put on the ballot And instead, we had the they had to be pushed under the ballot by voter initiative, and is now going up for election in November and the, for registered voters in the city of Santa Cruz by the city. I think it raises it $2 to $9-something an hour.
Could I read one more thing from the Seaside Company, and then we'll kill that subject?
Sure.
Okay. This is about employment again, and this was a piece of paper that was put out to all employees yesterday. It says, to all employees, just a reminder that in addition to hiring talented and hardworking employees from within our community, the Boardwalk hires employees from two other specific recruitment groups from outside the area. One group includes college students from work and travel. They come from many countries around the world to live in Boardwalk housing and work at Boardwalk jobs. You've probably already met some of these college student employees. Some are rehirees returning for a second or third or fourth summer. The second group of imported Boardwalk employees are those who are in Santa Cruz through a mission with a college organization called Campus Crusade for Christ. These college students spend several weeks in Santa Cruz living in a nearby Peter Pan motel, and they will work at Boardwalk jobs for several weeks of the summer. They also work in local churches, leading Sunday school and attending training. They host some very creative parties at the Pan for friends and coworkers. They have been parties with Hawaiian and 70s and weird proms and some of the past themes. Because there are not enough people in Santa Cruz to fill the very large number of jobs in the summer, these two groups of employees are very important to our business. Having them work here allows us the flexibility needed in operating the Boardwalk on the long shifts, explanation long in big long letters and dashes, during the summer when so many employees are not available to work the very late, in big long letters, night shifts that we really need them for on those big extra busy days. And that all has to do, again, with this thing they signed that they don't have to abide by any overtime wages. Anyways, I think they deserve a lot of scrutiny, and they need to do a little bit more for our community.
Well, you obviously need to call Tony Madrigal, our city council member of Hispanic origins,
in the city council,
who has led
open.
A march or two of his own in the beach flats, mostly, I feel, kind of company-type marches. I think on one or two occasions he was about... usurious rents. Tony Madrigal's number, I believe, is 420-5026. Perhaps we should call him on the phone and have you speak to his answering machine directly.
I would love to.
We could possibly...
I'll have to only give him my email address for reasons at this time.
Okay, well, that's fine. We'll see if we can actually get this guy on the phone. It's quite possible. Let's see what we got here. I don't want to dial the wrong number. Yeah, it looks like we didn't dial the right number at all. Let's try again. One more time. Let's see here. 420-5026.
Name again?
Tony Madrigal is the council member's name. I might suggest he investigate a few of these issues or ask him if he will stand up for a just render proposals or whether he wants to do anything of that kind.
Hi, you've reached the voicemail for Mayor Matthews.
It's Mayor Matthews.
I'm
maybe you could talk to her instead.
I'm in and out of the office, but
I
do check my messages regularly, so please leave me a message, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Thank you.
Tony a call.
At the tone, please record your message.
I'll record it
for you. When you have finished recording, you may hang up.
Well, actually, there's always something to say to Cynthia, but I thought maybe I guess I got one of those numbers wrong. Maybe it's 2-8, not 2-6. Whoops for me. We do have a caller. Maybe that's Tony Madrigal.
Tony now.
Let's see what we got here.
Just wanting to talk.
Hi there. You're on free radio.
Hey, Robert. It's just Andrea. I'm on my way out the door, but Tony's number is 420-5028.
2-8.
Hey, thank you.
And for your guest there, Robert, you can call my house later, and if there's a number that I can reach them at, I'm going to be going over to the Peter Pan in the next few days because those people are leaving, and I've already made arrangements with them. Instead of them throwing all this stuff away that can be used, I told them that I'd come over there, and it's going to be, you know, probably some towels, maybe some blankets, I don't know what else, probably some miscellaneous stuff. And then I'm going to be looking to maybe take it over to the homeless shelter because last year they threw away all this stuff, and I actually salvaged a couple beach towels and some other stuff, and I even told them any leftover bottles of shampoo or bars of soap, tubes of toothpaste, and they're like, okay. So one of the girls over there is has gotten a couple boxes, and she said she's already started putting stuff in boxes. But they told me to come over there, I think, tomorrow afternoon, and should be all the way out of
Andrea,
there by Saturday or Sunday.
Andrea, let me ask you a question. Does Peter Pan have a regular feeding program out there?
No, they don't. I could tell you more about that in detail, but I can't right now because I'm already late and I got to get out the door.
All right, I want a full report.
I'll be happy to talk to you about that.
Give me a call on the Huff line later.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, thanks to Andrea for that call. Again,
yes.
If you want to reach me off air, it's 423-4833, 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom is the organization that I'm hooked up with. Tim, you have something you want to say?
Well, I just think there's one thing that's a very sensitive issue, I know, that I think is robbing our social services, though, that people start needing to be aware of, and that is faith-based money. It's this program that Bush came up with in 2001, 2002. It's been 5 years now with little accountability, and a GOA report just came out today. I've got it with me, but basically the report shows that it's a complete failure. Basically, all this money has gone into, here's a good example right here. USDA awards $5 million in faith-based money for food stamp participation grants. Now, instead of enhancing the social services that we need, what a lot of this faith-based money goes to is to pamphlets being drawn up to draw people to the social services that already exist. And instead of, like, giving more food stamps out, they just direct people to where you can get food stamps. But it's deeper than that. You know, the money goes to churches, and a lot of churches do good stuff with it, but there are churches that complain about it, and here's a really good example right here. this is Eddie Jessup, who works for Fresno Metro Ministry. Says there's a lot of money out there to address the homeless issue, but is being poorly used. Jessup said Fresno County runs out of money in September of their emergency shelter, most all distributed through the Salvation Army for rent and mortgage to keep people in their housing before they lose it. Very little spent on an emergency shelter for those in the street already because there isn't enough. Meanwhile, the city council and some community-based organizations spend shelter money by putting people up in ratty hotel rooms for 4 nights at the cost of a full month's rent, further expending money only to support bad housing at exorbitant costs, far from the services that might help people get back on their feet or for their kids. It is a shameful way for a large metropolis to handle a few resources. Part of the problem, in addition to others, is that all services are faith-based and perhaps a questionable use of federal money. They do good but limited work, and it results in turf wars. People have been had to leave shelters during the day and line up for night for a bed, and they'd be turned away without a place to go. It'd make tent cities emerge, engage the police, criminalization of the homeless. Exposing the land grab is righteous. Fresno should be ashamed. That's one minister's take on the faith base.
Fresno, yeah. It would be nice if we could get a tent city here or two, whether it's provoked by faith-based misuse of funding or not. You know, I've always found it really hard to deal with the kind of... I mean, you're talking about federal funding. Often the churches can be very... As individual churches, they can be very compassionate. They can be very concerned. I mean, often they'll stand up for the right, for example, and as a minister down in Buena Park, Wiley Drake does. He's an extreme right-wing Republican, but he stands up for the people who are homeless people he puts up in his church, even if the city he's in, you know, threatens to put him in jail. And I have a lot of respect for that. But the fact of the matter is, you know, in terms of actually dealing with the majority of people who need support, neither the city council locally, nor the state, nor the feds, nor the churches here have any real interest in addressing that problem. You know, I mean, for all kinds of reasons, you know, whether it be they fear there's a magnet effect, or there's not enough money, or, you know, it would drive away the tourists, or whatever their concerns are. It's not something they want to address. They would rather treat people like fugitives and criminals and subhumans, which is, in fact, what is happening every night in Santa Cruz because of the city's anti-homeless sleeping ban at 11 o'clock. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. In the studio with me, Tammy and Tim. I'm Robert Norse. I want to remind you of a couple things. I'm going to play a little music in a moment just to give us a break from all this clattery tongue-tanging here. But there is a show tonight, which it's free if you can't afford it. You should kick something down if you can. It's $8.50 if you can afford it. It's called Can't Stop the Clock, and it's playing on at the Club Caution, which is on... It's on Front Street at about Cathcart, a little bit beyond Cathcart. I think you head up toward the metro. I could be wrong. Maybe you head down. Anyway, it's around Cathcart and Pacific Club Caution. It's a play which I've talked about, and my companion talk show host Thomas Levitt has talked about. He also stars in it. He's one of the lead actors in it. Concerns protest in Santa Cruz against the war, first Iraqi war and the second Iraqi war, and against oppression of homeless people at the town clock, hence the name Can't Stop the Clock. Currently you can stop human rights, but this clock keeps on ticking. But it's funny, it's passionate, it's very well done, considering it's a kind of a limited effort. It's directed by Nicholas Whitehead, Nutcracker Nick, as I call him, and it's going to be playing tonight at 8 o'clock and again on Saturday, day after tomorrow, again at Club Caution on Front, and I encourage you to go check it out. So that's my word on that. I've also got a couple of other announcements, which I will hope to dredge up here. Clive Bustrade, you may remember, the guy who got jailed for, I don't know, was it 4 or 5 months for driving 27 miles an hour up a 25-mile-an-hour road. That's how he described the felony, endangerment, reckless driving. The police were after him, in essence. The sheriffs were after him is what it boiled down to. And he's appealing that case. He went to court on Tuesday, and he's got a delay of a month. He's trying to get one of the bad judges removed in federal court in San Jose. We'll have a further update later in case you were following that situation. He also has this program for basic rights for people, which he wanted to see distribute more widely. Literature he's putting out and different means of monitoring police misconduct. It's at coppercards.org, I believe. Coppercards, www.coppercards. It's either .org or .com. I'm never quite sure which one it is, but it's one of the two. Coppercards, anyway, is the relevant word. I also want to announce in my own case, you may remember your very own favorite talk show host here is facing trial on the case of... I want to talk my 2 minutes at city council. Mayor Rotkin, formerly mayor, now shadow mayor and running again for the city council. But this was back in 2005. Had me arrested when I stood at the microphone waiting for 2 minutes to speak, or for my 2 minutes to speak. Instead, he said, no can do. And I said, I want my time. Anyway, that resulted in an arrest. I face a year and a quarter in jail as a possible maximum for disrupting a meeting and resisting arrest, or in essence, actually, it's called obstructing an officer, an interesting phrase. The trial has been endlessly postponed, most recently because we got information that the court either had not gotten police complaints about the main police officer involved in this case, Lieutenant Steve Clark. Steve Clark is, coincidentally, the head of the Internal Affairs Department of the Santa Cruz Police Department, which is the section of the Santa Cruz Police Department that supposedly investigates complaints. Sort of the Vogel do-it-yourself investigation approach. And Clark is a particularly... I've often found him very nasty and snide, and more so than other police officers. And I say that not because he injured my hand and was involved in the first violent assault on me by a Santa Cruz police officer, although I've been arrested at least a dozen times in Santa Cruz on numerous nonviolent protests. None of them ever injured me in that way. I say it because I think I generally have seen him acting in this, he has this contemptuous manner towards people. I mean, maybe it's just a personality difficulty. Hard to say what it comes from. In any case, he also lies under oath. I saw this because we took a deposition from him and he lied 3 times, by my count. And the problem, of course, is when you have police officers lying, it's kind of hard to prove, and they know that. And that's the reason they can do it, because they have the power. They have the organization, they have the weaponry, they have the collusion with the local judges and the local politicians, Rotkin and Matthews being just two of those. And this is a collusion that doesn't happen because of a conspiracy or I'm going to sit down and, you know, help this bad guy. It happens because politicians rely on the police department for all kinds of things, and they don't want to really believe that there can be corruption and abuse in their police department. That just doesn't really compute with them. Anyway, we took Clark to court. We didn't take him to court. I'm being taken to court, and Clark is a primary witness, and so we wanted to get information about who might be available to impeach Clark's testimony. And the way you find that out, as I've described in past shows, is you make a pitches motion, a motion that says, give me the names of everybody who filed a complaint against Clark for the specific concern you have. In my case, it's excessive force and lying on police reports. Well, Judge Burdick came back 3 months ago and said, nothing. I've looked up all the complaints, because you're not allowed to see them. He goes and looks at them privately. The city attorney goes with him. The police officer goes with him.
But you're not allowed.
But the defendant is not allowed, and the defense counsel is not allowed.
No. But the police officer.
But the police officer is allowed, because the justification of that is it's a personnel record, and therefore it's confidential. That's the argument.
You terrorist.
In theory, it's to protect the police officer. It's a personnel record. You know, that's the rationale. It has a plausibility, and in some cases, I can respect that. But the issue that comes up is. And that came up in my case was Attorney Kate Wells chatting with other people found that there were two complaints against Clark that had actually, one of which had been sustained by the police chief himself about false use or improper use of public records. Another had to do with lying in a police report, which hadn't even been investigated, but had been filed. And so I wanted the names of the people who had filed those reports so I could get them, bring them into court to suggest that maybe Lieutenant Clark, at least to some people, was not the shining, virtuous, truthful fellow in all times and places that he may be regarded as, because he has a shiny blue uniform on, you know, and he's a lieutenant in the police force. Mm. Well, Burdick got very angry in court. And what I'm going to do, actually, is I'm going to call Attorney Kate Wells. She's actually agreed to discuss this issue. And let's see if we can get her on the line. Because she's really the person to talk to on this issue. We're giving her a ring now. Maybe she's slipped out knowing I'm about to call. It could be.
Hello?
Attorney Kate Wells.
Hey.
I'm calling you, invading your sanctity again at home. You're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Okay.
And I was just telling the community about the Pitches motion and how Judge Burdick initially found no problems, nothing against Lieutenant Clark, but then... I wasn't actually in court, but you went into court, I guess it was on Tuesday at 10 o'clock.
Right.
And you had an experience that kind of surprised you.
Well, yeah, it was a bit surprising. As it turns out that, you know, there had been a complaint filed against Lieutenant Clark, accusing him of lying in a declaration that he's sworn declaration. That he submitted to the court in a different case, in some other case. And as it turns out, we thought that hadn't been brought to his attention, because surely he would not have passed that over. He would have given it to us.
Not brought to Judge Burdick's attention, Judge Paul Burdick.
Yeah, we figured that it just hadn't been omitted from the file somehow. Accidentally.
And you actually, this wouldn't have been the first time that this has happened.
No, that would not have been the first time.
As an attorney, you found this to be the case, not necessarily with the Santa Cruz Police Department, but with the Sheriff's Department. The complaints you knew had been made,
right,
were for some reason were not coming out in Pitches motions looking for those complaints.
Correct. Right. And even when they were filed, the judge managed to overlook them.
Oh, Jesus.
So... That was Judge Danner.
Yeah, that was the judge. Yeah, the of Drumhead Danner. Or
in the Pinto case.
As I used to call him. And so, you know, that was in the Pinto case where the sheriff's deputies, where there were complaints filed against the sheriff's deputy, one of which was from you, right?
That's correct.
And that, for some reason, had been placed in the special Richard...
No, actually, that was actually in the file.
It was in the file.
And Judge Danner... What the process is that they review them in camera in their chambers.
But with the city attorney or the district attorney present,
with the city attorney or the county council, in the case of the sheriff's office.
I see. So, but you, the defense is not allowed to be there because it's considered a confidential personnel matter. Right?
That's correct. They're going through his confidential personnel file.
Right.
So defense counsel is not permitted to be in there. So in the first case, the Pinto case, I had told the attorney, Bill Minkner, that we had filed complaints against this officer, Jason Nielsen.
Deputy Nielsen, yeah.
Huh?
Deputy Nielsen.
I've heard him.
Right. And he said, oh, don't worry about it. I filed a pitches motion, you know, meaning I'll get him through the court. Well, he filed his pitches motion, and then Danner came back on the bench after looking at the file and said, oh, nothing there, clean as a whistle. And so Minkner, knowing that there were at least two complaints filed against this guy, said, well, wait a minute, Your Honor, I know of at least two complaints against him.
So now, in this case, did Judge Danner, and this was several years ago, did he suggest in his initial statement that there were no complaints at all or that there were no relevant complaints?
His comment was literally clean as a whistle.
Huh. Whereas,
now you take that to mean whatever you want.
So, but in perhaps in contrast to Judge Burdick's case, where he looked at the record, he didn't say there were no complaints in the case of Lieutenant Clark. He said there were no relevant complaints.
That's correct.
And then on 10 o'clock Tuesday, when you raised the issue, actually raised the issue through papers before that there were in fact two complaints that you thought were relevant. What was Judge Burdick's response?
Well, initially, you know, like I said, we kind of thought, well, they must have not been in the file because surely he would not have passed over a complaint of lying when we are in. That was specifically, in fact, what we were looking for was any complaint that they had lied. And the law states that it does not matter if the complaint was sustained or whether or not they were exonerated, it doesn't matter. They're still supposed to turn over all complaints that are relevant.
Mm-hmm.
So we made a motion saying, wait a minute, you know, what about this complaint? You know, and he came back and said that he had seen that complaint, and he deemed it not to be relevant.
And was he sort of gracious and apologetic to you?
Oh, gosh, no. He was very offended that we would dare to question him. Of course, we didn't know at the time, or at the time we filed it, whether or not he'd even seen the complaint.
It might have been that the police department had not given him the complaint.
Correct.
Which had happened with the sheriff's department some years before.
That's correct. But he seemed to think that we were somehow questioning his integrity by instead of questioning the integrity of the police department, which was we thought that probably the best possibility.
You know, when I've made complaints about police officers, when they used to be a Citizen Police Review Board, I always requested that the complaints I made be put into a public file, because otherwise they get locked away, and the only way to get at them is through these pitches motions at the discretion of a judge who may not want to let you see who's making the complaints. And
or at the discretion of the police department who may not want to turn over the complaint.
And even if both agree that you have the right to know who made the complaint, you don't get to see the complaint. The complaint itself remains confidential, right?
That's correct. You just get the name and phone number, last name, the last known phone number and address.
So the irony here is a member of the community wants the community and the police department to be aware of a concern that she or he has about the behavior of a particular officer. So they make a complaint, and you ask them, do you want it public? And almost every time I've talked to someone, they said yes.
Mm-hmm.
But the Citizens Police Review Board gave me a lot of trouble. Finally, they allowed a public file.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't tell people that the complaints could be put into a public file initially, so we had to do initial work on that. Now, of course, with no police review board, all the complaints go directly to the internal affairs, and none of them are kept in a public file. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, my point is, okay, you know, maybe the process of investigation might involve confidential witnesses. Maybe the process of the commander's comments on the lieutenant might not be something, might be a part of the personnel record. But the original complaint, certainly should not be confidential per se.
I agree.
But the minute they put it in a personnel file, then suddenly it becomes stamped confidential.
That's right.
Yourself have suggested that you find this process, you talked about this earlier today, so abusive that you would like to see, you're considering a recommendation to a grand jury about this issue?
Yeah, I think I would like to, now that this has happened twice, and I mean, you have to understand the serendipitous nature of how I found out about this complaint against Lieutenant Clark, number one, and number two, how serendipitous it was that I had told Bill Meitner that we had filed complaints. If he had not found out for me, it would have gone totally unknown, and never, no one ever would have known that there were complaints filed.
So it was coincidental in both these cases. It just happened that you happened to talk to another attorney who said, "Hey, I know about some complaints that were filed about this person."
That's exactly right.
It sounds
a
like
very
you need
credible
to have
source said we happened to be chatting, and I said, "Well, we filed the pitches against Sergeant or Lieutenant Clark, and it came back with no complaints of him lying."
Now, so what you, in a way, you had some of the information you were looking for because they came from the secondary source. You knew the name of the person who filed the complaint, who actually is a relatively reputable person in Lieutenant Clark's case, right?
Absolutely reputable person.
And is it okay to talk about who this person is?
I think probably since the case is ongoing at this point you know, just at the risk, and this person hasn't been contacted yet, I would rather keep that private.
I see. Well, remember, though, of course, I mean, I appreciate your doing that. Whenever anybody tells me that, I say the police probably already know about it because they're, you know, the DA probably knows full well. In fact, hasn't the DA...
No, but the person himself doesn't know about it.
Right, okay.
And I don't want to offend him by going on radio and divulging his identity before I'm able to talk to him.
Right, and I know that person's been out of the country or out of the area, so you haven't been able to talk to him up until now. But didn't the district attorney in this case, Archie Weber, who is prosecuting me, make a surprising proposal about what was going to happen in this case around this witness, this individual?
Well, yes, he did. He basically said, no, he didn't. That's wrong. We have some motions that we're going to be making to either exclude evidence, exclude testimony of certain people, blah, blah, blah. Okay? He wants those motions to be heard early because if they're not successful or if we are successful, he might think about dismissing some of the charges.
Specifically, as I understand it, if Lieutenant Clark is actually going to have his integrity seriously questioned by a reputable person, and that's the person that you found and you haven't yet contacted, and the judge Burdick was so concerned about, you know, who didn't want to give you the name and said, "I've already looked at it before. What are you bothering me with this for?" In so many words, glared at you, as you, I think it was described to me. The district attorney wants to specially bar that person from testifying in my, you know, so that he can't impeach the credibility of Lieutenant Clark, right? Is that right?
Well, sure. They're definitely going to seek to have their testimony excluded.
Now, what's the situation in that kind of a scene? If you were a judge, not a defense attorney, under what circumstances would you allow an individual like this witness to testify, and in what circumstances would you not allow it? What are the standards here?
Well, the standards are that if it's a credible, and really, in fact, that's not for the judge to decide how credible it is. It's for the jury to decide, ultimately. It's a factual issue, and it's the believability of the person who has brought the complaint. And as long as the district attorney has a chance to cross-examine him in front of the jury, him or her, if it is relevant, in other words, it calls into question the credibility of the complaining witness, who is Lieutenant Clark in this situation, then they should be allowed to testify. There shouldn't be a question.
So Lieutenant Clark is accused of lying in a complaint that was upheld Well, actually, there were several complaints, but one complaint that involved at least one charge against Clark was upheld by Police Chief Scarry. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was misuse of public documents.
Misuse, which is, in a sense, I don't know, misuse of public documents. I'm not sure if that's falsification or not. Maybe Judge Burdick found that was not relevant because misuse of public documents isn't directly related to either excessive force or to lying on a police report, although I don't know. I mean, but the other complaint was lying on a police report, right?
Lying in a declaration submitted to the court.
Lying under oath.
Right.
So
sworn declaration.
If he's going to lie under oath, then you might say there might be some question about whether he'll be telling the truth in my trial.
Well, absolutely.
And one would wonder how a judge could possibly consider this not relevant, and how a second judge, because I guess we're going to we're not going to be going before Judge Burdick, right? We'll be going before a second judge.
We will be in front of Judge Guy.
Judge Guy, a new judge in Department
mm-hmm.
1. How could a judge possibly say it's irrelevant what this witness would have to say about Lieutenant Clark? I mean, if you're a judge, under what circumstances could you say this and reasonably say that in your mind?
The only evidence code section that might apply is that sometimes they exclude testimony. Or evidence where it's more likely to be prejudicial than it is to be probative of a material fact. Do you understand what I'm saying there?
Translate it into American.
Well,
I'm
trying to here, but you know, all right. A case of, for instance, you got a case where there's a bloody victim, and they're really horrible, horrendous photographs.
Uh-huh.
They have been known to suppress that, not to show that kind of evidence to the jury, because it's so prejudicial that they're afraid it will sway the jury into believing this person's guilty. Even, you know, it's not probative of whether or not the person's guilty.
So, but is there any way in which you could argue that evidence that Lieutenant Clark lied on a declaration
No.
So it would be hard to find that. And yet, in the past, when you brought before Judge Danner in this earlier case, your desire to have witnesses testify as to the lack of credibility, actually Mr. Minkner's case and the Pinto case,
mm-hmm.
did not Judge Danner deny that out of hand and say it was not relevant?
Well, apparently, as a civil rights attorney, I have given up my ability to testify in court, at least according to Art Danner, because they tried to paint me as a cop hater, which I'm not. You know, I'm a bad cop hater.
But doesn't the jury have the right to make that decision?
Absolutely. It was a ridiculous decision.
Well, it sounds more than ridiculous.
Actually, the ruling was that it was going to take too long, because the district attorney in that case had a stack of all of the cases that I had ever filed against the cop on behalf of a client. And he was going to go one by one through every one of those complaints with me.
And Art Danner had a date that night.
And Art Danner did not want to deal with it all. He said it was going to take much too long, and so I was excluded.
What happened to the defendant in this case, Pinto?
He was convicted, however, not convicted of the... he was convicted of initially this kid ran from the cop. So they convicted him of, what did they convict him of?
Obstructing an officer, resisting arrest?
I think it was resisting arrest or something.
That's what I'm charged with, of course.
Right.
I didn't run, but in fact, if I had run, it probably might have been better. They wouldn't have let me go.
Yeah. Okay.
Hey,
anything else?
So this hearing is coming up on the 30th of August at, I guess, 10 a.m., right? In Department...
What date? 30th of August?
30th of August, 10 a.m. in Department 1. That's my recollection.
Okay.
And I'm wondering, is it something you think the public might be interested in coming to? Is it something that'll be interesting, or what do you think?
You're talking about the in limine motion?
Yes.
It probably wouldn't be that interesting to the public, but, you know, it might be. I don't know.
I mean, they will be trying to say Lieutenant Clark should not be challenged by this witness, and you will be trying to say, oh, yes, he should, right?
Right.
Right. So in a way, I mean, to me, this has to do with the integrity of the judicial system, not just with my case. I mean,
right.
It has to do with whether they can, a judge can arbitrarily exclude. And this is a new judge, right? This not the one we're going to be doing. Judge Burton, the one who Burdick, who originally did this.
Will not be the judge.
He won't be the judge, but he is a new judge who you initially thought, and you may still think, has not been jaded yet by the court.
Well, I had hoped.
But jading can happen pretty quick. Any other updates on the Quigley or Henry cases that you know about?
Yeah, actually, there's the Attorney General's gotten involved in Quigley's case again, and there's going to be a hearing, an emergency hearing on Monday at 1:30 in Watsonville Court to sort out what's going on, because they're claiming that what Judge Barton has done is unlawful and outside his jurisdiction.
We're talking about Barton's claim that helmet tickets,
as applied, is unconstitutional.
And therefore, you can write off helmet tickets as infractions, or you don't have to go at all to have.
No, you don't even. Well, in fact, this is a good place to say this. The Santa Cruz courts have now deemed that Barton, as an expert on the helmet law. All helmet law tickets will be transferred to him, and most likely will be summarily dismissed by him.
Huh.
So all of you bikers out there who want to ride without your helmet, you're probably safe.
However, they can continue to write such tickets with no fear of a lawsuit.
Sure, they can write them. They can write them, but it's going to look bad if they continue to do so when they know that they're just going to be dismissed.
And the Maurer case has successfully been settled. You've gotten the 25 G's, and I guess
it's
John has got his five. John has gotten his money, but are you going to wear your fuck the pigs button next time you come downtown, Kate?
I'll always wear that. That doesn't bother me.
Hey, we're talking with Attorney Kate Wells. Any other thoughts, anything you want to say for us out here?
Nothing I can think of right now.
Thanks for taking the time.
Okay. Thank you, Kate.
Nice. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Kate Wells, attorney at law. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. In the studio with me, Tim and Tammy. You can be in the studio, too. 427-3772 is the number. Here's a little Phil Oakes in the studio.
Oh, look outside the window. There's a woman being grabbed. They've dragged her to the bushes, and now she's being stabbed. Maybe we should call the cops and try to stop the pain. But Monopoly is so much fun, I'd hate to blow the game. And I'm sure it wouldn't interest anybody outside of a small circle of friends. Riding down the highway, yes, my back is getting stiff. 13 cars are piled up, they're hanging on a cliff. Now maybe we should pull them back with our towing chain. But we gotta move and we might get sued, and it looks like it's gonna rain. And I'm sure it wouldn't interest anybody outside of a small circle of friends. Sweating in the ghetto with the colored and the poor. The rats have joined the babies who are sleeping on the floor. Now wouldn't it be a riot if they really blew their tops? But they got too much already, and besides we've got the cops. And I'm sure it wouldn't interest anybody outside of a small circle of friends. Oh, there's a dirty paper using sex to make her sales. The Supreme Court was so upset they sent him off to jail. Maybe we should help the fiend and take away his fine. But we're busy reading Playboy and the Sunday New York Times. And I'm sure it wouldn't interest anybody outside of a small circle of friends. Smoking marijuana is more fun than drinking beer. But a friend of ours was captured and they gave him 30 years. Maybe we should raise our voices, ask somebody why. But demonstrations are a drag, besides we're much too high. And I'm sure it wouldn't interest anybody outside of a small circle of friends. To the bushes, and now she's being stabbed. Maybe we should call the cops and try to stop the pain. But Monopoly is so much fun, I'd hate to blow the game. And I'm sure it wouldn't interest anybody outside of a small circle of friends.
Account from Bruce Hedenberg here of an assault that happened what evening?
Friday night in Davenport.
About what time?
About 10:30.
And by a Deputy E, and involving a nightstick, pulling hair out of his head, flinging him down to the sidewalk, and bogusly charging him with several.
So we're back on the air. We're talking with Roger Mensch. Hi, Roger.
Hi, Robert.
And Roger, you we had lots of discussions with you about a year ago when you were charged with your work with the Hemporium and providing marijuana, medical marijuana, for folks up in the Felton area.
Yeah, Santa Cruz County.
And you were, I guess you spent 5 days in. Well, how many days in jail did you spend for that one?
Talking about my first case or my second case?
Your first case.
My first case, I spent 5 days.
And then you were given a probation condition that allowed you to continue to sell marijuana medically, correct?
That's correct.
And yet 3 months later in August, you were arrested again.
Yeah, that's correct.
And since then, you've been fighting this and are now going to trial, I guess, a Monday morning in, what, Department 5? Is that right? Or
No, it won't be a Monday morning. It is Department 6, and it's going to be October 16th.
Okay.
I guess they're going to allow me a caregiver's defense, possibly this time. We'll see.
Now, what are you charged with exactly? What is the, what are they claiming you have done that is wrong?
They're doing the same thing they did to me last time: possession with the intent to sell, cultivation. Even though they found enough, just enough for myself here.
What is really going on here in your mind? Why are they going after you again? Is this the same DA? Is it the same sheriffs? How did this happen again?
Well, I don't want to go into those details. Other than they have chosen to come after me and prosecute again, even though I have a caregiver's card, even though I'm a paid care provider for two people to live on a property. The judge says that he's going to let up to the jury to decide if I'm a caregiver or a collective. And, that's what all this Medical Marijuana Act was supposed to curtail, is the arrest of people like me. And, we tried to have it dismissed the other day. And they chose not to, although I will not be, the ammunition charge will be set aside, that won't be heard.
So you'll be, I knew before there was something about a gun and a locked safe or some silly.
Well, yeah, in my last case, if they can find you guilty on a felony and if you have any guns around, they can get you on special allegation gun charges, which they did with me. Although there was no ammunition for the two guns I'm charged with. And so that's all in the appeal of my first case.
And that's still being appealed.
Yeah, it's still in the process. We do know the justices have read all the briefs in that case. And I actually feel pretty confident, but you never know. There's a new case, an appeal case that went down September of last year. And, you know, it's one of the cases we use in my case. But, you know, basically they have just not recognized the Medical Marijuana Act, SB 420, and, you know, the officers, all they want to do is say that there's Proposition 215 and don't even look at the new law, right?
So have you had any communications with people like Andrea Tischler, Lisa Milano, Theodora Carey, activists who've been involved in supporting medical marijuana, and indeed some of whom are pushing this tax and regulate initiative at the city level? I mean, it seemed bizarre to me the first time that this case came your way. It seems even stranger that they're doing it again.
Well, I don't see it be stranger. It's the this medical marijuana task force, or the marijuana task force they have in Santa Cruz County. You know, they have their own agenda, and once you're in their scope, it's like they're not going to let go, it seems like.
Have you talked to any of the other care providers about this issue? Is there any solidarity and support of you, or how's that going?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, of course.
I mean, this seems to me not just like an issue of you alone fighting a case. It sounds like a political prosecution.
Oh, well, I believe so, too. I shouldn't be saying too much, I suppose, at this time.
Because you have a case coming up, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I need to talk with my attorney about what I should say and what I shouldn't.
And that's Attorney Ben Rice, right?
Yes.
Who has been successful in other cases, I believe.
Yeah, he's one of the most prominent medical marijuana attorneys there are.
In the studio with me is Tim Rumford, who is himself, he when he was a kid, he got busted for a leaf. I guess, I don't know if you were a care provider or just a recreational smoker, Tim. You had a question which Roger Mencher may or may not be able to answer. Go ahead.
That's an easy question, Roger. I was just curious, who you were arrested by, was it the sheriff or the city? Was it MET? Was it the Marijuana Enforcement Task?
I'm sorry, speak up again. Your mic was down. Sorry, Roger. Go, give it to him again.
Sorry about that. I was curious who you were arrested by, either city police or sheriff, like the MET, Marijuana Enforcement Task.
What is your question?
Were you arrested by city officers or by sheriff?
No. Yeah, the county medical or the Marijuana Task.
Marijuana Enforcement Task. MET, yeah. Gotcha. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
And how did they treat you? Were you actually taken into custody, jailed again? What was the deal on that?
Yeah, actually, I was jailed again for 7 days, and that judge basically he didn't shut down my business. And before they left me out of jail, the detective in prosecution went to another judge, got another search warrant, came back and cut down all the crop that was here for the collective, and then they released me from jail.
Have you been able to resume your business, or have you been cut off since last August?
I don't want to talk
about that issue.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but let me ask you this. I mean,
they wiped my computer, mm-hmm. right? They took my phone. They tried to destroy my life and our existence here.
And there's been no public outcry from Valerie Corral or Lisa Milano or any of the other people about this issue?
Well, people know about the issue, and we were hoping that it was going to be dropped yesterday, but it hasn't, and now it'll become more public knowledge.
Well, I hope you continue to publicize. I know last time there was a lot of letters of recommendation written for you. People can find this on www.santacruzindymedia.org, the old site on the web, which had a lot of discussion. How do you spell your last name, Roger?
It's M-E-N-T-C-H.
And people can look up the details of the case, the details of people who supported you, back and forth. And if you're able to post anything at all, let us know what's happening. Keep the court dates, you know, let us know when they're coming up so those who want to be supportive can be supportive. What can people do to be helpful?
Well, I call prosecution's office, I suppose, if people wanted to and complain about the, you know, it blows me away that how many people were prosecuted back here, and there's no media attention brought to it whatsoever.
Now, do you know of other cases that have been also prosecuted similar to yours, people who are supply medical marijuana in the last year, or is it just...
Well, personally, I haven't, you know, although I hear of different ones that are going down. I don't know any names per se, but I know it definitely happens, and I know that there isn't anything in the papers about it.
I know. This is the first I've heard about it. I know you've been kind of, you know, keeping it quiet, perhaps hoping that there be some resolution if you kept the hush-hush thing going. But,
well,
yeah,
you know, I didn't want to jeopardize our
your
position, and neither do I want to at this point.
Yeah. Well, all right, so your suggestion is people can contact the prosecution and urge them to drop the charges. Again, how many charges are you facing? What's your potential total penalty?
Well, there's four charges: sales, possession, cultivation. I'm not sure about the other one. And then the ammo charge was the excess ammo they left from my first arrest. That's another judge, Stevens, who actually will see that. That's a probation violation. But the first case is on appeal, and if I win on appeal, then that ammo charge isn't even... You know, it's worthless. It's no good whatsoever.
Well, an interesting issue has been raised here. Since you've been on probation, why are they bothering with we're talking about a jury trial in October, right?
Yeah.
But don't they, why do they have an obligation to do a jury trial if you've already accepted probation? Can't they simply violate your probation and send you to jail?
Well, they did. That's what they did. They said, I violated my probation, arrested me this last time.
And held you for 7 days.
Yeah, and I still have this probation hold thing going on. You know, I'm not sure how this all works. I have two different judges, Judge Stevens and Judge Almquist now.
But you've been out of custody since that 7 days in jail.
Yeah, right.
So they aren't saying to you, okay, we're taking you in for a probation hearing, forget the trial,
that's still on the books, but it is put on to where it comes after my criminal case. My probation violations won't be heard until after my criminal case.
Interesting, because normally, you know, they say if you're found guilty of something, they don't even have to, they could choose not to try to try you for the criminal case. They could just charge a probation violation, get a preponderance of the evidence standard, and lock you up on the basis of that without even a trial.
Well, I don't know.
I'm surprised. I mean, I'm pleased that they aren't doing that, but I don't want to give them any ideas, mind you. Hey, Roger, I appreciate you taking the time. And again, if anything I can do, please give me a call on the Huff line at 423-HUFF. And any other, you know, comments you want to make to the community about this case?
You know, I'll be in contact with Lisa and Andrea and Valerie. You know, I'm just going to work to promote more knowledge about the case and the prosecution at this point. And so anything anybody can do, you know, talk to anybody, any of the board of supervisors or whatever. You know, they have been non-responsive in my first case. And I really haven't even thought. Well, actually, I did. I sent an email to Mark Stone, and I got an email back saying that he deleted it without reading it. So
charming. And,
yeah.
Wow.
Well, we'll see.
Hey, keep me advised.
All right, Robert.
Good to hear you, Roger.
You guys have a good one.
You too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Wow, that's Roger Minch going to trial on October 16th for cultivation, possession, and I guess, is it sales? That's one of the three of medical marijuana in the enlightened county of Santa Cruz. We haven't got much time left here, and we got Tammy in the studio. You wanted to talk about some police misconduct that happened to you. What's that about?
Yes, I basically, it was brought to my attention after an issue had passed in a scenario on Ocean Street where I actually do some volunteer work for my community in the church and help the Hispanic community, as I was saying. And I happened to be on Ocean Street, the lower part, where they were doing a cocaine sting. And I was sitting with a lady friend there, and away from where actually there was no trafficking at the time when I was there. There was nobody outside or hanging out like loitering or anything. So I felt it was a good time to go there and talk to my girlfriend at the time. And
what time of day was this?
This was at 2 p.m. in the afternoon.
How long ago?
It was last month on the, I believe it was the 18th. And anyway, I was harassed as soon as the police drove in and did some harassing of some boys up further from where we were sitting. And
harassed in what way?
Questioned. I say harassed because we were nowhere near the people that they were after. So it was
what questions did they ask you?
Well, they wanted us our IDs and our actually I got my picture taken without a reason, just look up at the camera and when they were asking me for my ID, and I had asked, why is my picture being taken, and nobody would answer me. They just went about.
How many police officers were involved?
There was seven that showed up.
Seven police officers. What was the crime being investigated?
I didn't understand myself until the next day. But in the Sentinel had my name mixed with all the people they arrested, and I got a phone call that day.
You're famous now.
I'm famous with humility.
Smeared in the Sentinel.
Yes, and it was brought to my attention by a lot of church elders. Where I'm at.
Cocaine sting, you say?
This is, yes, and there was two done that day, I believe, in that area. And these are known areas, which is everybody basically that's local does have knowledge of this. And it's not really our job to do that, deal with that. My job as a human, I love and enjoy to help other communities or people in need.
Did the Sentinel correct this? Did you tell them this wasn't me, and did they print a retraction?
Yes, they did, but with a phone call, and I had to bring it to their attention, and they had to look up the code themselves. And the guy actually laughed and said, "You know, you're right. That it's for thinking about loitering."
No. We're talking about this is the crime that they arrested others for, or they arrested you for?
They did arrest me.
They were investigating. They did arrest you. You were under suspicion of loitering with intent to drug traffic. Is that correct?
No, for thinking about loitering.
Well,
conspiracy
to loiter?
Yes.
You know, I really would love to see that. Have you guys still got the citation somewhere in your possession?
Well, I have the, with me, but there is a code on it. And
let me check that code. Back to me on it, because I want to know. I suspect it was this loitering with intent to sell drugs, because loitering laws generally are not constitutional since the Larson case of 1982, when a black guy with dreads in the L.A. area was successfully challenged them at the federal level, but since then they have allowed this limited kind of loitering law. They try not to use the word loitering in these laws. So, for example, in the parking garage paranoia law, which you're not allowed to be in a parking garage for more than 15 minutes, it's really a no loitering law. And even if you're parking your own vehicle or your own bicycle, and actually you're not allowed to be there at all unless you are parking your own vehicle in any of the city's parking garages. Although they haven't got it posted yet, so, it may not be actually in effect. They're not enforcing it, unless you're a homeless person, of course.
Right.
But they have a new law that they can add to it if there's intent to sell drugs or some other horrible, horrendous crime like that, then to clean up the neighborhood and make sure that your kind is not loitering they can do more. I haven't got much time left in the show, but is there something more you want to say? You want to talk about any particular police officer that gave you some concerns?
Very much so, because...
make it short. We've got 3 minutes.
Yes, it's Mr. Officer Hernandez and Garcia put together, I think, with them two. I would like some responses back from other victims that have been harassed or that they have
lied. These were the officers who arrested you?
Yes.
Were you handcuffed and taken to jail?
No Miranda rights read.
Yeah, they don't have to read you your Miranda rights unless they question you. Were they questioning you?
Yes, they were.
Then they did have to read you. Then they were improper in not doing so. Mm. I want to talk to you more about this. We are running out of time, though, so I'm going to ask, anybody's had problems with Officers Hernandez, Garcia, and I might add with Lieutenant Clark, please give a call to the Huff line, 423-HUFF, particularly in the last few years. You can't go too far back in time on that issue.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I'm kind of curious what's happened to the porta potty in parking lot 4. That's you might say, what is this, a big deal, a porta potty missing in parking lot 4? That's the farmer's market parking lot. Well, it's one of the only porta potty left in town. That's the only 24-hour bathroom. So I think we should all start crapping on City Hall, if that's what, get there, particularly on the Public Works Department. I don't know where, on the Police Department. I don't know. The people that took this away really pissed me off. It looks like we're running out of time on this show. So we'll be talking on, again, I encourage you to check out Can't Stop the Clock. That's opening even now as we speak. And if you can't get to tonight's show, check out the show on Saturday. On Saturday there's going to be another show that'll be happening. My goodness, it's Uncle Dennis, a face I haven't seen in some time. He's back in the studio, which means I'm out of here, folks. I want to thank you for being with me on this edition of Bathroom Spears Broadsides. We've had Tim Rumford and Tammy Singh with us. We're going to have them again, hopefully, because they got more to say. I'll be back on Sunday at 9:30 in the morning, and you're welcome to join me between times. 423-HUFF is the number to call. And while you're pondering that one, here's a little Phil Oakes to keep you company while Uncle Dennis sets up. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathroom Spears Broadsides.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
I don't know, but it seems that every single dream is painting pretty pictures in the air. Then it tumbles in despair, and it starts to bend, and by the end it's a nightmare. But I'm gonna give all that I've got to give. Cross my heart, and I hope to live. I don't know, but I find the speedy hands of time are wailing out a warning on the wall. But nobody heeds the call, and the soldier obeys while the parson prays for his downfall. But I'm gonna give all that I've got to give. Cross my heart, and I hope to live. I don't know, but it's true, so many things you do please you so they leave you feeling warm. It's the calm before the storm, or the habit grows, and before you know it, you're deformed. But I'm gonna give all that I've got to give. Cross my heart, and I hope to live. I don't know, but I feel the safety isn't real, with everybody acting all the same. For the rules will ruin the game, so So I go my way laughing while they say that I'm insane. Yes, I'm gonna give all that I've got to give. Cross my heart and I hope to live. I don't know, but I see that everything is free when you're young, the treasures you can take. But the bridge is bound to break, and you reach the end screaming, it's all been a mistake. But I'm gonna give all that I've got to give. Cross my heart and I hope to live. I don't know, but it seems that every single dream is painting pretty pictures in the air. Then it tumbles in despair and it starts to bend, and by the end it's a nightmare. So I'm gonna give all that I've got to give. Cross my heart and I hope to live.
And welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 www.freakradio.org. Here's your CD, Robert. Robert, of course, will be back Sunday at some ungodly hour, like 8, 9:30 in the morning, something like that, to talk with y'all about more things to do. And Jesus loves you, Robert.
Oh, thanks.
Yes. Don't forget your Jesus love you card. I'm Uncle Dennis. I'm in here sometimes, and sometimes I'm not in here. I'm stopping in tonight for a brief visit, and then I will be on my way again, doing various and sundry things out in the world. So, anyway, one of the things we do here is a radio show called From the Cream to the Dregs, and we feature music of the 60s and 70s, such as this.
Riders on the storm, riders on the storm, into this house we're born, into this world we're thrown, like a dog without a bone, an actor out alone. Riders on the storm, there's a killer on the road. His brain is squirming like a toad. Take a long holiday. Let your children play. If you give this man a ride, sweet family will die. Killer on the road. Yeah. The world.